This episode is brought to you by Loading Bar. Based in three locations, Stoke Newington and Peckham in London and Brighton on the South Coast, Loading offers video game aficionados somewhere to drink, relax and play. Visitors can expect a welcoming space full of free-to-play games, the latest consoles, fresh ground coffee, signature cocktails and video game-themed live events. Visit loading.bar for opening times and more information.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a legendary British video game designer. While a student at Manchester University, a friend invited him to write a text adventure, which led him to work for the video game publishers US Gold and later Activision. In 1990, he co-founded Revolution Software in the north of England. And after releasing Lure of the Temptress and Beneath the Steel Sky, he began work on Broken Sword, a world-spanning adventure game starring the American lawyer George Stobart and his French girlfriend Nicole Collard. The game had a witty script, was beautifully illustrated, and featured a soundtrack by Barrington Furlong, the composer of the Inspector Morse TV series, whom my guest had first met over a game of cricket. After Sony reluctantly brought the game to PlayStation, it became a smash hit, leading to a string of successful sequels. But the course has not always been easy. The audience for adventure games is limited, he once told me, but that audience is also incredibly loyal. Welcome, Charles Cecil.
Pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So can you tell me a little bit about growing up in what was at the time, I think, Zaire in Central Africa? Have I got that right?
The Belgian Congo, and now it's the Democratic Republic of Congo, I think. Or maybe it is Zaire. One was the French colony and one was the Belgian colony. But no, I was actually born in London in 1962. We lived near Notting Hill. And quite an exciting start to my life. I was very young, and there was a knock on the door, and my father opened it. It was a secret service, and they asked if they could bug my room, which I was a few months old. My parents were very excited by that. And it turned out that we lived next to Ivanov, who was having an affair with Christine Keeler.
Wow.
And so the secret service obviously wanted to find out what was going on with regard to John Profumo. Yeah. Obviously, the youngsters listening to this won't have any idea what we're talking about, but it was, you know, it was quite an exciting time.
Yeah, there was a recent BBC dramatisation, wasn't there, of the Profumo affair?
There was.
Did you feature in that?
But, you know, I don't remember. What a good question. My mind is now racing back, and I'm trying to remember exactly. I think they might have missed me out, which was a terrible shame. But what London was, and again, there's quite a lot of coverage of this, but London was dreadfully polluted, and there was awful, awful smog.
Is it?
And 1963 was a particularly cold winter. My mother recently told me, actually, that a Thai woman told her that the best thing for a baby was to put it outside in the freezing cold for an hour. So she did that with me. It was too cold for her, so she went back inside, leaving me in this, you know, brutally cold winter and amongst the smog.
Oh, poor baby Cecil.
But I have to say, I've never actually been ill in my adult life, so it can't have done me too much harm. But anyway, she was so appalled by, you know, bringing a child up in this atmosphere, that she managed to convince my father to apply for a job as an accountant. Well, he was an accountant. He applied to Unilever and was offered a position in the Belgian Congo.
Right.
And the Belgian Congo had just got its independence from Belgium under the rule of the incredibly brutal, incredibly cruel King Leopold. We arrived rather naively, sailed up the River Congo for hundreds and hundreds of miles into the heart of darkness. Then the Americans decided that the new president, Patrice Lumumba, was too pally with the Russians. So they assassinated him together with the French. And this fury erupted, and they rounded up the whites in a nearby town of Shoppable. And we were airlifted out.
How soon after you arrived did that all happen?
About a year later.
Right,
but my mother, you see, was about to give birth to my sister.
Oh, my gosh.
And they said, you just have to leave now. So she got on a light aircraft, was evacuated, taken all over the place, but thankfully didn't give birth until she arrived back in Brazzaville, which was the capital. So, and then we went to Iran and various other places and then back to London when I was about six or seven.
Poor. That's quite quite an adventuring first few years you had there then.
I think irresponsible parenting would be called now, but it was great. I wish I could remember a bit more of it.
Well, you know, the format of this podcast is that I'm asking you to select your five games that you want to put on your very own fictional mini console. Your first one dates from 1979. Can you tell us about it?
Absolutely, yes. So the first one on my fictional console is going to be Galaxian. Galaxians came out in 1979, and I left school in 1980, and I thought I wanted to be an engineer. I still love Victorian engineering, the creativity and the technology and the way that the two merge together. And in many ways, I think video games reflects that idea of the aesthetic and the technical coming together in harmony. God, that sounds very pretentious, but you know, if you think of beautiful steam engines, the reason they're so beautiful is because of their functionality. And I think a great video game does the same. I got a sponsorship with Ford. And
to go to college, you mean, or to apprentice?
To go to university, yes. Okay. Yeah. And we had a year out beforehand, and it was a phenomenal year. The recipient of something called the Special Engineering Program. Yeah. And we were told that we were going to be the captains of industry. And Ford put us through the most extraordinary training program. We learned about, we went to law college, we went to business school, we went into the factories, learned a bit more programming. Learned metalwork. I absolutely, you know, loved my time there. There was a friend, or I became friends with somebody who had just started a home computer company, Arctic Computing. He disassembled the ROM of the Sinclair ZX80, which had 1K of memory, and had published it. And we used to go to the pub and play Galaxians together. Galaxians is a beautifully simple game. I'm sure that everybody listening to this will of course know it.
Just to quickly describe the game, it's a sort of a little like Space Invaders, but the enemy spaceships or aliens, aren't they? They fly in from different directions and they're multicolored.
And they're multicolored, but they also follow patterns that you come to recognize. And I mean, I think at the core of it, like Space Invaders, you have a bullet that appears at the front of your ship, which scrolls horizontally along the bottom of the screen. And when you fire it, like Space Invaders, it'll go up the screen until it hits either the top of the screen or an enemy spaceship. But only at that point does another bullet appear on your... In other words, you're left vulnerable while your bullet is in midair. And that's at the heart of it, where the gameplay loop is.
Right.
Because if you it becomes extraordinarily frustrating if you miss, because then you're spending your time avoiding the aliens. Whereas if you could shoot them effectively, then bullets reappear. And this friend of mine, Richard Turner, as I say, had just started a computer games company, and he, we used to go in the evenings, have a few pints and play this game, tabletop game. And one day he said to me, you like telling stories. Why don't you come and see what I'm doing? Come up to Hull, which is where his parents were, where he started this company. And his friend Chris Thornton had a TRS-80, which was a Tandy computer from the US that was much more advanced than the ZX81s that we were used to, the Sinclair ZX81s, with our 1K of memory. We started playing some games, and he said, look, why don't you write an adventure game? I'll program it and see where we go. And that was my first game. Adventure B, he'd already written one. So Adventure B, Ink a Curse.
Amazing. And so you'd finished your studies, and or were you still at Manchester University at this time?
Oh, no. Still, this all started in the year between school and starting.
Oh, right. Okay.
And then I went to university, as you kindly introduced me, to Manchester University. He was in Hull. So every weekend every Friday night I'd drive off, meet him in Hull. And we would write games, play games, run the company. And to begin with, it was phenomenal. W.H. Smith's, at the time, was the main retailer of home computer games. But they only took games for a company called ICL. And they were dull. And we tried to get our games into W.H. Smith's, but they refused to take them. And one day, Richard phoned up or went to see the manager at W.H. Smith's in Hull. And said, would you take some of the games? And he said, look, I'm terribly sorry. We can't pay you in advance, but we will pay you once they sell. I said, okay. So on Saturday morning, he got up early, took them 20 of our games, got home. An hour later, the phone rang. It was the manager of W.H. Smith's. He said, they've all sold out. Can you bring some more?
Wow.
And
good moment.
I mean, isn't that phenomenal?
Yeah.
And suddenly W.H. Smith's realized the extraordinary opportunities that they were losing. They appointed a buyer, a guy called John Rowland. I remember him very well because he was such an important part of our business. And I'd write a new game, then phone him up. And in those days, the phones would go beep, 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 and you'd have to put 10p in. And it was just really embarrassing to phone the buyer from W.H. Smith's on a public phone box. So I'd have to go scour Manchester. And in the city centre, they had new phone boxes where you could put the money in first. And God help you if you ran out of money, but otherwise they would never know that you were ringing from a public box.
Seems much more professional.
It seems so much professional, exactly. I found out, but go, John, yeah, hello, John Rowland, yeah, hi, John, this is Charles Cecil from Arctic Computing. And the bus would go past, and I'd put my hand over the, go, oh, hello, Charles, how's things? I go, we've got a new game, Adventure C or Adventure D or 1K Chess or whatever. And he'd go, oh, right, and so this new adventure, what's it like? And it was a bit like the last one. He went, send us 5,000. Oh, okay, John, there, put the phone down. And that was it. And
I have to say, Charles, this is it's incredibly enterprising of you to, in your weekends and your first year of university, to be running a company like this. I mean, that's certainly not something I would have been able to do. Where did this organization come from?
Well, I have to say that my social life took a dive, because it meant that every weekend I was away.
And you're also, I mean, you know, selling 5,000 games to WH Smith, you must have been, you know, earning quite well for a student.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
How do you cope with that when you're 19 years old or 20 or however old you were?
But we were sort of boy racers. We got, as everybody was, we got... RS 1600 Ford Escorts, and they already had, you know, fuel injectors, and we put turbochargers on them. And I lived in a place called Hume, which was next to Moss Side in Manchester. It was really rough.
Quite rough, yeah.
I mean, I loved it, but it was described as the worst housing project in Europe.
Right. Maybe not the best place to have a really expensive car then.
No. I mean, I did get a little garage. But I remember Richard bought himself a Lotus Esprit Turbo, and I drove that in. I had to back it into this, and hope that nobody had seen it. Because if anybody had seen it, it would have been gone within an hour.
I was surprised the police didn't think you were, you know, a drug dealer, essentially.
Well, that was, do you know what? We started paying rent. I started paying rent for this place, which was £7 a week. And like a girl that was living with me said, nobody pays rent. So I stopped paying. And nobody said anything, because it was so grim that Manchester City Council was attempting to get the funds together to knock it down. But in that sort of in-between period, we were effectively squatting, because it was so derelict that it had been condemned. And so what happened was that it was drug dealers and students, and that was it, because... You know, the families, thank goodness, had been moved out, because it was too, you know, it's too grim, and none of the lifts work, and there was dog shit everywhere, and cockroaches. The police almost certainly wouldn't have gone anywhere near it, because, as I say, it was drug dealers and students.
So let's wind the clock forward a little bit, and so you leave Manchester and you join Arctic Computing. And at some point you move into publishing, is that correct?
I come to the end of my university. I've got to decide whether to take up the job offer with Ford, which is very lucrative and has been planned out, or go into computer games and go and work for Arctic. In retrospect, thank goodness, I choose the latter.
Yeah. Did your parents have anything to say about your choice?
No, to be fair, they didn't. No. Like, my parents are fantastic. My father was a chartered accountant, so he gave very good advice. But no, they were very supportive. But that's a great question, because, you know, certainly as a parent, you would think that it would be much better for your child to go into a top company like Ford, rather than... It's very easy in hindsight to see how huge the video games industry was to become. But at the time, it felt like it was, you know, home computers were like yo-yos, that they would peak and then disappear. There was no indication whatsoever that there was going to be this incredible growth. And then about 1984, Commodore started coming in, Nintendo started coming in, and, you know, this very, very safe little cottage industry was absolutely decimated. I went to work for Arctic full-time, more out of loyalty than anything else, because, you know, the writing was on the wall that this company was just, you know, going into a tailspin. Which you did.
So after you worked for US Gold for a bit, and then you moved to Activision. We will get to your second game in a minute, but just quickly, I think people would be interested to hear what Activision was like at that time. Was it? I mean, I assume it was very different to the Activision of today.
It was a very different Activision. Yes, it was very tough in many ways. My manager in the US simply didn't care that there was an 8-hour time difference, so he'd phone me up midnight. And right. Expect me to get back to him. And more broadly, I did. But I was young. Many nights, I would sit all night with the developers and have a snooze in my chair, which, you know, was crunch and is extraordinarily counterproductive. And so I'm not, you know, in any way endorsing it, but it's what we did.
Yeah, it's so... The picture you paint is so 1980s, I have to say.
I know. Yeah, well... Well, actually, I'm telling you that the guy I'm talking about is called Jeff Mulligan, and he was my Uber boss. He was my boss's boss. I remember I'd been at Activision for about 6 months, and he phoned me up and he said, "Look, Chuck," because he'd call me Chuck Cecil. He said, "Chuck, I think you need to come out to San Francisco." I go, "Okay, Jeff, yeah." No. And so I went over, and I was, you know, he'd given me such a hard time, but, you know, that was par for the course, and I arrived on the Wednesday, we did some work on Wednesday and Thursday, and then I turned up on Friday morning, you went, Chuck, we're going out on the boat. And I said, but Jeff, we've got all this work to do. He went, Friday, boat day. He had a what's called a cigarette boat. It was basically a drug smuggler boat, powered with 2 5-litre engines. It went so fast. We went out, and I remember going in this boat at maybe about 120 miles an hour and hitting the wake of the Alcatraz ferry and going up and going back down, and everybody was cheering. And in the evening, after a few hours, we chugged into this wonderful place where they served us tequila top cocktails. And I was going, this is what he does every day. He gives me a hard time. But actually, he's out on his boat all the time. He came over to London, I remember, when we were based in Reading. And I was rowing, and I still row. And he went, Chuck, yeah, I gather you row. He said, I'd like to challenge you to a rowing race. I'm okay. A few months go by, and I go, Jeff, what about this rowing race? He go, okay. So he got the whole company to my club, which was in Hammersmith. And he got into a boat, and I got into a boat. He claimed that his boat had got lost in stuck in customs or something. I don't remember. Anyway, so, and the Thames is flowing really, really fast.
Is this a proper skull boat?
Yes, this is a proper skull boat. Exactly, yes. So the Thames is running really fast. My boss is Rod Cousins. His boss is Jeff Mulligan. So he's my Uber boss. And I'm going, God, this is... So we get into the skull, and the CFO who's been brought along from America shouts, go, we go. He turns straight over. He thinks because he can he's good on a skull, you know, on an ergo, that he can skull, and all hell breaks loose because the water's going really fast and he's being dragged towards the hull of a boat, and if he goes between those hulls more together, he's going to drown.
Oh gosh!
So he is utterly humiliated. He's pulled out. And he looks at me and he goes, right, we'll do the rowing machine. Okay Jeff. Like, okay. So I go first, and, you know, I'm pretty fit, and I do a, you know, 2,000 meters. I do it in however many, you know, seven and a half minutes or whatever. And he goes on there, you know, he's cut his foot, so there's a bit of blood coming out, and off he goes. And he's like sort of bat out of hell for the first minute, and then he slows down, and then he goes paler and paler and paler until he's completely white except for the blood oozing out of his foot. And he's way, way, way behind me. And it's like, this is not the way to go forward of the American company. This is not what you do.
No. Shaking his fist at you, damn you, Chuck Cecil.
Exactly. He stood up, and he had to be held up because otherwise he would have fainted. Oh
wow.
I don't know why, okay. I do it. I don't know why I do it.
So that's how you came to leave Activision.
Exactly. That is how I came to leave Activision.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
No, what actually happened is Activision left itself. It was the American side. The British side was very run by Rod, was very wily and made quite a lot of money. The US side was, I mean, I really like Jeff, so I'll take him out of this, but there was, they were just a bunch of slobs. And there was this terrible sort of American self-confidence. There was no humility whatsoever.
So how did you get from there to founding Revolution Software?
I'd wanted to get back into development. A good friend of mine, Sean Brennan, he was now, at this point, deputy at a company called Mirasoft, run by Robert Maxwell, father to Ghislaine Maxwell,
yes,
of course.
The media mogul.
He was a media mogul. He was alive at this point. And Sean said, look, if you, we need products, we're expanding rapidly. If you wanted to go back into development, we would be very receptive to supporting you. So I was really excited by this because I wanted to get back into development. And I teamed up with somebody who had worked with at Arctic called Tony Warriner, and he suggested that a guy called Dave Sykes get involved. And so I started exploring the idea of getting, you know, starting a new development company, Writing Adventures. And then Jeff turned up, Jeff Mulligan, and said, Chuck, I've got some really bad news. We're going to have to make you partially redundant. Could you work just 2 days a week? You know, would you mind?
Right.
And it's like, oh my God, what a great opportunity. So I said, Jeff, well, I think I can probably, you know, I could probably do that. And it was, yes, let's, you know, I've got 3 days a week to set up a new company, which we initially called Turnbell, and let's see where we get to. So Tony, I gave Tony some of my savings to write, start writing this adventure game, which of course was going to turn into Lure of the Temptress. And I had the time plus half my salary from Activision.
Amazing.
So and I'd been completely open. It was their request that I work part time, and it was just a great way to be able to start a company.
Yeah, which presumably meant that they didn't own your IP.
Yeah, yeah, not at all. Yeah, yeah.
And then Robert Maxwell dies, doesn't he? At sea, had you challenged him to a rowing race?
Robert Maxwell was, I mean, dubious, more dubious even than his daughter. And what had happened was that he owned the Mirror, the Daily Mirror, which for anybody outside the UK is a tabloid newspaper, not much loved by Meghan Markle and her husband, I suspect. He had a yacht called the Lady Ghislaine, named, of course, after his daughter Ghislaine. And one day he mysteriously died, drowned. And it turned out that he'd been stealing money from the Mirror Group pension fund, and the whole thing collapsed. We were midway through our first game, Year of Temptress, when the company collapsed. And so we were able to terminate the agreement. But I think I'm jumping ahead of myself here.
Well, I could listen to you talk about these days for forever, but I'm conscious a little bit of the format, the podcast.
It is a 2-hour podcast, yeah. Isn't it?
So it's not too far of a jump ahead to 1993. Do you want to tell us about your second choice?
Yes, my second choice is Day of the Tentacle. And the reason that I'm going to choose Day of the Tentacle is because it uniquely managed to mix both the slapstick humour, brilliant humour, but also the logic. It wasn't completely illogical in the way that so many other games at that time, so many other adventures at that time were. You know, the classic puzzle that for anybody who's played will remember is that, you know, you need to run a hamster wheel to generate electricity. So, of course, what you do is go back in time, freeze a hamster, send it through time frozen, and then put it in the microwave to defrost it so that it can create electricity so that you can blurdy, blurdy, blurd. And the point is that actually these were games, this was an adventure that had been really, really well structured and really well thought out. And it was so much more than just the gags. And I found it quite inspirational, I have to say.
Did you see yourselves as sort of the British LucasArts at that time?
Well, we were compared to LucasArts, but to be honest with you, no, I didn't. Because rather naively, I think we saw Sierra as our big competitors. And LucasArts was still pretty under the radar at that point.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. From our European perspective, we saw them very much as sort of equals.
So just to go back to the story of your career then. So Mirasoft collapses with the death of Maxwell. And then, so you then spend all of your time working on Lure of the Temptress. And at which point, you know, how far along the development of that game do you found Revolution?
Tony, and I owe him a huge debt of gratitude. We're still great friends and he's a really good guy. He is prepared to leave his job, which is more than I am. He took delivery of the PC that I loved so much. I used to play flight sims on it. Absolutely loved it. And works in Hull to write this game. We meet every couple of weeks. And then we come up with the basic design, which is something called virtual theater, which is the characters walk around the world talking to each other, exchanging information. In principle, it works. I mean, the theory works a lot better than the practice. Although we did get fantastic reviews. Our reviews were mid-90s, so we didn't do everything wrong. But in hindsight, it's quite a frustrating game to play. But anyway, it looked beautiful. After probably 3 or 4 months, maybe 6 months, we realized that it's about time to present to Mirasoft. Tony drives down, and I felt so passionately about my PC, I demanded that he wrap it in a blanket and put it in a child seat. Wrap it up in a seatbelt.
I like the visual of it being in a baby seat, though. That's good.
Well, exactly. So he drives down with Dave, and I had a small flat in London. He parks outside, and you know, comes in, and we start talking, planning, have a glass of wine, another glass of wine, drink a ridiculous amount of wine, given that we've got a big presentation the next day. Wake up the next morning feeling a bit blurry-eyed, and there's something that's been nagging away at me. And I look out of the window, and I see that somebody's broken into the car. And what's been nagging me is that we've forgotten to unpack the PC, and it's been left on the back seat. And I realized, to my horror, that if that PC's gone, that is the end of the demo, but that's the end of Revolution, because there's no way on God's earth that we can afford to, you know, rewrite all this code and buy another PC. And I dash down to the car to find that actually the thief has stolen the radio, but they've left the PC on the back seat. And so Revolution lived to breathe another day.
Wow. Maybe you just thought it was a pile of blankets or something. Yeah, cool.
The head of marketing, Alison Beasley, who's still doing PR actually, phoned me up, I remember, and said, look, we've got to come up with a name for this game. So, okay. And so I faxed her a list of names. And at the bottom, I put Lure of the Temptress, and I put in brackets. We can't call it this, by the way. And of course, you know, the one thing I've learned since then is don't ever tell marketing things that you don't want them to grasp onto, because she grasped onto this and said, we love Lure of the Temptress. It has to be called that. And I said, look, Alison, honestly, the reason I said it can't be Lure of the Temptress is the game has no luring, nor does it have a temptress. And there was a silence, and she said, can you put one in? I went, really? She said, yes. So what Mirasoft did is they extended it by 4 months so that we could rewrite the whole story so that it fitted the name that the marketing people liked.
Oh, wow.
But the irony is that during that 4 months was when Robert Maxwell fell off the back of his yacht and died. And had we not extended it, then Mirasoft would have published it, gone bankrupt. We would have been in really big trouble. But as it was, we got the rights back and we could then go to Virgin.
Wow.
With the game at the beginnings of the new game, which was going to be Beneath the Steel Sky.
So you owe it all to the Temptress after all.
to indeed, yes.
Okay, let's go forward a bit to 1996 and your next choice.
Yeah, I'm going to go for Mario 64. My children were young, but they started playing games, and I used to play Mario 64 with them. We'd had a number of adventures that had come out in 3D and looked terrible. 3D was the big future, but people weren't quite sure what to do. And what Nintendo have an absolute knack of doing is writing games that use the technology at its current state. And they've continued to do that throughout. And Mario 64 looked beautiful. It was simple, but the camera was phenomenal. And it just was a great game. To me, it was the first game that really moved into 3D. And I enjoyed playing it with my kids. They were much better than me, even though they were only five or six. To me, it epitomizes the way that Nintendo can innovate.
And 1996 is the year when the first Broken Sword comes out, and which is obviously so different to Super Mario 64, isn't it? You know, it's determinedly 2D and animated, you know, beautifully hand-drawn. So were you concerned that the world of games was moving to 3D at this time?
Not for Broken Sword 1, but for Broken Sword 2, absolutely. For Broken Sword 1, Sean Brennan, who is now the deputy at Virgin, had seen how successful Lyra the Temptress and Beneath the Steel Sky had been, and basically asked if we could raise our ambition so that we could compete with Sierra and LucasArts, who had much bigger budgets than us. And Broken Sword was the result. I felt, you know, great serendipity. I'd read in Edge magazine that there was a college called Ballyferber College in Dublin, which would be set up to train animators and layout artists for the Dolby Studios in Dublin. And the Dolby Studios had closed, but they were still producing, you know, extraordinarily talented students. I went over there to try and find some animators, and I was shown around by a gentleman called Owen Cahill. And Owen was lecturing in layout. He'd worked at Don Bluth for all his life, actually. And he asked to see what we were doing, so I showed him some roughs. And he was a little fellow, and he sort of squealed with laughter, and he said, "Those are terrible." He said, "I'm going to show you what I do, and you're going to employ me."
Wow.
So he did show me his layouts, and I did employ him. And he was just a genius. I owe him such a huge debt of gratitude. So much of the look of Broken Sword came from him. He always challenged, and it would drive us nuts. It would drive my team nuts. They refused to talk to him. But I have this knack of recognizing and collecting genius people. And, you know, they might be problematic. They might be difficult. They might talk too much. But if they're really good, you just put up with that, because ultimately the end result is going to be better, much better because of it. And he was a classic case. As I say, people just would refuse. My team would refuse to talk to him. But I wouldn't, because I knew that when he pushed and he pushed and he pushed, there was always a really good reason for it.
Yeah, the Don Bluth studio also made Dragon's Lair, didn't it? The arcade game. And I hadn't ever connected the dots there. But yeah, there's something of the Dragon's Lair in Broken Sword's appearance, at least.
But you're right. Yeah.
Interesting. So, and as well with Broken Sword, you sort of benefit from timing as well, in the sense that it's, you know, around the time that Sony's PlayStation, the first PlayStation, is having its ascent. How did you convince Sony to put the first Broken Sword on that machine, which doesn't seem sort of particularly well suited to an adventure game?
When I was at Activision, this lanky guy called Phil Harrison was very, very keen to get into the industry. And he did a design. I think he did a design for Warhammer for us. It never came to anything. And then he phoned me up in about 1995, 1994, and said, "Look, I'm working for Sony now. There's this new console called the PSX. Would you like to come and see it?" Now, in those days, the Japanese has Nintendo and Sega. You would never in a million years have approached an independent developer. So this was quite special. And I went down to London, went to Sony, and he did a demo. And it was the famous one with the Tyrannosaurus head.
Yes.
It was absolutely phenomenal. And clearly what he was after was visceral 3D games. So when I presented the idea of doing Broken Sword, you know, there was very little interest. Virgin had already rejected it. They said, you know, nobody wants to play a 2D adventure on the PlayStation. And then a guy called John Roberts, who I knew, and Martin Alltimes became our champions. They kind of really bulldozed it through because they thought it might work. Then went on to review, and you know, nobody had very high expectations. It got 9 out of 10 from the official PlayStation magazine, which in those days, I think, had a circulation. Was it 600,000 a month? They gave it 9 out of 10 and extended coverage because they loved it so much. The German, and they cover-mounted it as well. And the Germans did the same and the French did the same. So basically, we were talking about probably 1.5 million cover mounts. And the game did phenomenally well. And everybody was just blown away, particularly Sony, because they hadn't had any sort of expectations. And years later, I remember one of the accounts person saying, this game just keeps selling. It just keeps selling. It's extraordinary. And you know, I remember with Broken Sword 2, which is not as good as Broken Sword 1, but Broken Sword 2, the official PlayStation magazine ran a poll, and it came in at something like number 6, was 6th best PlayStation game ever. We were ahead of a number of the Tomb Raiders. We were ahead of some of the Resident Evils. It was just mind-blowing.
Yeah. I mean, it was so... I remember playing Broken Sword 2 when I was young, and it was such a good game to have on in the front room with other people pitching in and going, why don't you try this with this? And, you know, so it was a sort of a communal experience, wasn't it? And also, I think the fact it was illustrated and, you know, beautifully animated like a cartoon meant it just didn't date. So, you know, with, you know, the Tomb Raiders, it felt like each new Tomb Raider came out, obviously superseded the last one because the technology was so obvious on the screen, whereas that's not the case with Broken Sword, is it? They sort of endure in a different way.
Well, extraordinarily, I mean, back in those days, once a game went into retail, and then after 6 months, it was dead. What happened through the early 2000s is retailers and the publishers scrapped to see how they could maximize their own profits, and both of them discovered, or the publishers discovered, that the best way to do it was to screw developers. So, you know, for Broken Sword 3 and Broken Sword 4, They were successful. Broken Sword 3 was very successful for THQ, but we made a loss. We'd had to borrow £200,000 to finish the game and never quite recouped. So, you know, we went through this process of basically mothballing the company because, you know, you can't keep writing games and losing money. And I thank Apple for this. They basically opened up the opportunities for digital distribution. We were able to republish Broken Sword 1. You know, and I'm very proud of the fact that, you know, this is a game that was originally from 1996, released, you know, re-released 10, 11, 12 years later, and it still has a Metacritic score of 91%. The idea, as exactly as you say, that the idea that these games just don't date is extraordinary, which brings us this incredible catalogue, because we own the IP to all our own games. You know, back in that, now in 2023, we have all of these games. It's phenomenal. It's a huge privilege to have been able to go through that journey.
So your fourth choice is a game that I think has dated, perhaps more than the other ones that you chose, but at the time just had this monumental impact. Can you tell us about Grand Theft Auto 3?
Yeah, Grand Theft Auto 3, I think, absolutely epitomises the very best of the PlayStation era. What I loved about it was that, for me, it was the first game that truly merged narrative with emergent gameplay. To me, it was perfect because it was a fairly small map. There was a story that was always followable, but then this emergent gameplay, which mixed with the story brilliantly. Again, my son David, who now actually works with me at Revolution, but he was 7 or 8. We didn't allow him to play Grand Theft Auto because it was 18. But I remember him watching me. In particular, one scene where you go to the docks and you have to shoot somebody through a telescope. And I kept failing. And he was going, really? I was saying, Dad, I can do it. And I knew that he could have done it. But do I let him play the game, even though he's only like 6 or 7, an 18 game, and then allow me to progress? And I'm afraid that I didn't in the end. I decided that, you know, the responsible thing to do was to say that he couldn't play. And I never got beyond that part. But for the you know, 4 or 5 hours that I played it, I absolutely loved it, and I would love to finish it many, many times and explore the world more. But, you know, it's just an absolutely brilliant game, and congratulations, and fantastic that, you know, it's a British game as well, I'd say. Earlier on, I was talking about, you know, the analogy with engineering, and again, this is a classic. It uses technology, it uses the story, it uses the emergent rule set brilliantly, and, you know, congratulations to all involved.
It's a few years after GTA 3 comes out that you get a call from Hollywood, I think. Can you just tell us a story about the invitation you got to work on the Da Vinci Code?
What had happened was, as I said, is that we'd mothballed Revolution. We found ourselves in a position where, as I say, basically, THQ, who is our American publisher, had probably made about $5 million from Broken Sword 3, and we made a £200,000 loss. So I took on some consultancy work, and I got a call from Take-Two, and they'd licensed the Da Vinci Code, and they asked me if you know, I'd like to consult on it. Now, I'm quite competitive with Dan Brown, because our fans claim that he must have played Broken Sword before he wrote the Da Vinci Code, because there are so many similarities, according to them. Just in case there are any lawyers listening, you know, that's according to our fans. I would never make such a claim. So they asked me if I'd like to get involved. And I'm a little bit, yeah, my pride is there. Okay, well, like, yeah, I mean, I came up with this first, and here I am supporting Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code.
You spy an opportunity to ruin his film.
the money. The money, I'm afraid. They say, well, you know, we'll pay your consultancy. And I go, oh, really? And it was quite good. Oh, and we'd like to fly you out to Los Angeles. Oh, business class. And it's like, okay, my soul has been bought. They say, can you come and talk to Ron Howard?
So Ron Howard was the director of Da Vinci Code.
He's Hollywood royalty, and he was the director of the Da Vinci Code. And I said, well, you know, what should I prepare? Because I haven't given this any thought whatsoever. In fact, I said, we haven't actually signed an agreement. Don't worry, just turn up. That'll be fine. Really? Yeah. We're going to pay you a consultancy rate, and we're going to fly you over to Los Angeles. Okay. Wow. This is Hollywood, baby. You know, this is easy money, easy come, easy go. So I find myself on, you know, a Virgin flight, thinking about this game and how it might work. And, you know, the next day I turn up at Imagine Studios, which is where Ron Howard and his team are based. And I'm met by a woman called Julie, who's the senior vice president, Sony Pictures Marketing. And she says, Charles, thank you so much for coming. This is going to be a really contentious meeting. So if I was you, I'd sit at the back. I go, okay. In walks Ron with his entourage. And he says, Julie, I'm sorry, but I've got some bad news. There can't be a video game. And Julie says, these guys have paid, the money is helping your film. There's a contract. There's going to be a game. And Ron goes, oh, okay. It's got to come 6 months after the film. No, Ron, says Julie, it's going to be a day and date. That's the way it works. It's going to be day and date. So Ron's getting, you know, more and more. And he goes, okay, if that's what the contract says, but no marketing. Julie takes a breath and says, Ron, the contract is quite clear. There's going to be a video game. It's going to be day and date. And these guys are going to market it because that's the way it works. And Ron turns puce and he turns around and says, so Julie, what are you going to do with my story then? And Julie says, Ron, I'm so pleased you asked that question, because we've flown this guy all the way from England, and he's going to tell you what we're going to do with your story. So everybody looks around, including me, for this guy from England, who's going to tell Ron all about the story, and all the eyes are on me. And I have absolutely no idea what to say. So Ron says, what do you know about the Knights Templar? And I say, well, you know, I was invited last year, which I had been, to a nice Templar ceremony in Worcester Cathedral, of all places. And he said, really? And I said, yeah. I said, they had all the regalia, I said, and I don't know how authentic they were, but, you know. Oh, so where do you come from, he said. I said, I come from the city of York in England, which, as you'll know, Ron, is where Constantine the Great was declared emperor. And he went, no, I thought it was Constantinople. Went, no. He was declared emperor in New York and went on to found Constantinople.
Really?
Went, yeah. And I was looking around the room going, so he says, so what are you going to do with my story? And I lean forward and I say, Ron, we think that it's all about symbolism. Now, for anybody who's read the book, that is such an obvious thing to say because it is all about symbolism. And he looks at me and goes, do you know what? That's what we think in the film too. I went, well, that's great, Ron. It's great that we're together on this. He went, yeah. And I'm going, this is it. But it ain't. He leans forward. He goes, so can you give me some examples? And I lean back and I go, yes. You could have heard a pin drop. In medieval paintings, the Virgin Mary will always have a blue outer garment and Mary Magdalene will always have a red outer garment. And that is the way that a medieval audience would have known the difference. And that is an example of the symbolism that we're going to bring into the game. Ron gets so excited. He goes, oh my God. And we all get on like a house on fire. He'd walked in saying he only had 15 minutes. An hour and a half later, he walks out and he says, do you know, I'm really excited. This is going to be a great project. And, you know, it would have been a great project. We had problems with the developer. And actually, my contribution was very limited.
Okay, so Charles, we've come to your last choice here. This is from 2016. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, I'm going to choose a game from Playdead called Inside. I loved their game Limbo, which had come a couple of years earlier. And I guess, in many ways, for the same reasons that I love Grand Theft Auto 3, it was provocative. You start the game, a child rushes onto the screen, absolutely terrified, but you don't know what of. And suddenly you are controlling this child, and you don't know why they're terrified, you don't know what is in store. And what Playdead did so brilliantly is they told a really involving story without a word on the screen and without any dialogue. All of the gameplay was told through the background and through, even more brilliantly, through the gameplay. Inspired, I would have thought, by Fritz Lang's Metropolis, the absolute masterpiece. You know, and I remember in one particular bit of gameplay where you're controlling the character that has to walk in a robotic way because of all the robotic characters. And in doing so, it was conveying what the world was about. The Inside is one of the few games that I've finished multiple times. And this is certainly a game that I would be very, very happy to play many times more.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for these picks. It's been amazing to hear your stories. I've just got one last question. You talked about the longevity of the Broken Sword games. I wondered if we can expect to see sort of remasters of them on Switch or any contemporary platforms anytime soon.
Yeah, well, I mean, Simon, it's such a boring thing to say that, you know, that we can't talk. I can't talk. Basically, I have a wonderful community manager who gets so strict with me because I love. I mean, the one thing I would say is never tell me any secrets because I can't keep them. But as you say, as we're talking about, we have this incredible opportunity, and the next few years for Revolution are going to be very, very exciting because of that.
Oh, I'm sure everyone's looking forward to see, you know, what the next chapter is in that story for sure.
Bless you. Thank you.
What a great time that was. Thank you so much to my guest, Charles Cecil, and to you, of course, for listening this far into the podcast. I absolutely love Revolution's games. Broken Sword 2 was, in fact, the first one that I played, so I feel a bit more romantically attached to that one, even though Charles says he prefers the first game. And then early into my career, I reviewed, in fact, Broken Sword 3, and I remember after about 20 or 30 hours hitting a wall and just not being able to progress and having a giant panic and then getting in contact with the PR person who was handling it, who then got in contact with Charles, who told me that there was a bug in the game and it wasn't down to ineptitude, thankfully. Anyway, if you have not played any of the Broken Sword games before, go back, try them out. They're on Apple devices. They're on, you can get Broken Sword 5 on the Nintendo Switch. And I'm going to take it from that last answer that Charles gave us that we can expect to see other games from the Revolution catalogue appearing on current platforms soon. Let's hope that gets confirmed at some point. So this was one of the earlier episodes that I recorded this year at the start of 2023, before I had the format of the podcast completely locked down, which is why I neglected to ask Charles to supply us with a name for his perfect console that we can use to market it to the world. But I did email him more recently and asked if he could supply us with a brand name for his console. This is what he wrote in his email to me. "Hi Simon, Nintendo have beaten me to Revolution, and it would perhaps be a bit obvious. So I will go for Humdinger after a home computer prototype that I saw at the West Coast Computer Fair in 1983. I tried to license the rights for Europe, but that is a different story." And yes, indeed, I'm sure it is a different story. There's always another story when it comes to Charles Cecil, and we will have to have him back on the podcast at some point in the future and try to get him to share some more of those stories with us, the ones that are broadcastable at least. Thank you so much for listening this far into the podcast. I hope that you've enjoyed it. If you have, and if this is the first one you've listened to, then please do go back. We have had some fantastic guests over the last few months in these early weeks and months of My Perfect Console. Please do go back, listen to those. Some of you, I'm sure, are eager just to hear from game developers like Charles. We've had people like Eric Walpaw, the writer of Portal, on. You can go and listen to some of those game developers speaking, but then perhaps others of you are interested to hear from people working in other industries. So we've had comedians such as Dara O'Brien, Phil Wang, Susan Kalman have all been on. We have got some musicians coming up in the future. We've had actors like Ashley Birch, writers such as Heather Ann Campbell, and there's lots more where that came from. So I'm trying to keep the list as diverse as possible and trying to get people from different walks of life on. And so, yeah, if there's just one particular area where you prefer to hear from, then I'm afraid it's probably going to be a bit more diverse than that. But yeah, there's something there for everyone, I hope. And I'm trying to just keep it as the most interesting individuals who I can get access to and who are willing to come and talk about their love and passion for games. If you'd like to write to me, you can do at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Please do write to me with any thoughts and suggestions for guests. Many of you have done so, and I have written to quite a few of those people. Not all of them are available or willing to do it. Some have said they would like to do it, but they're too busy at the moment. They might do it later in the year. So if you have written in, then, you know, rest assured, I am working my way through that list and hoping to hear back from people. If you would like to follow me, you can do at Simon Parkin on Twitter. You can also follow the podcast at My Perfect Console, with the O's removed from console, where you can get sneak previews of guests coming up. And also you can read the lists of the games that people have chosen, previous guests have chosen. If you want to support the podcast financially, please pop along to Acast Plus, where you can become an early access supporter, and for just £3 a month, you will get your episodes 24 hours early and ad-free. It's also just a great way to support what I'm doing. A lot of work goes into these. I do run ads, of course, but supporting in that way is a wonderful way to show that you would like me to keep doing this. So thank you for those of you who do that, and thank you just for those of you who have left kind reviews and messages. Okay. All that remains for me to say is I will be back in a few days. Throughout April, we've got two guests a week, and I will have one more guest. There are five choices and one more perfect console. Until then, goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.